Mysterious illnesses, horrifying operations, dubious remedies, and unfortunate predicaments. This hour, a collection of some of the most bizarre medical cases. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest today is medical historian Thomas Morris. His latest book is titled The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine. In it, Morris describes genuine medical reports over the span of about 300 years, such as the American sailor who swallowed more than 30 knives during his life, and the 18th century Dutch practice of treating drowning victims with tobacco smoke enemas. Well, get ready for some of medical history's weirdest and wildest cases. First, this news.
There's a lot of women that's coming out, you know, and expressing themselves about what happened to them.
I really hope the Me Too movement is propelling us in that direction where assaulting people has consequences.
I think it's important that we listen to all of the women that are coming out and telling their stories and work on how we can engage them in a healing process.
The Me Too movement has led many people to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It has sparked conversations and controversy and maybe even change. I'm Charity Nebbe. Look for Unsettled, Mapping Me Too, a new podcast from Iowa Public Radio in the iTunes Store and on Google Play, or find it at iowapublicradio.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A puzzling series of dental explosions, a dubious tale of the spontaneous combustion of an 18th century aristocrat. Well, get ready this hour for some of medical history's weirdest and wildest medical cases. My guest is Thomas Morris. He's a medical historian. His new book is titled The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine. In it, Morris draws on genuine medical accounts over a span of 300 years, from the early 17th century to the turn of the 20th century, reports of mysterious illnesses, horrifying operations, dubious remedies, and unfortunate predicaments. Thomas Morris worked for many years as a BBC radio producer, and he's written for The Lancet, The Times, The Financial Times. His first book, The Matter of the Heart, A History of Heart Surgery, was a winner of the Royal Society of Literature Gerwood Award. Thomas Morris joins us today from London. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Let me ask you to describe a little bit. We'll get into a lot of these cases this hour. They are, well, at various turns, hysterical, but also cringeworthy. Tell us a little bit more about this collection of cases and what prompted you to write about them.
Well, it all started about 3 years ago when I was working on my previous book, which you just mentioned, The History of Heart Surgery. And I spent a lot of time while I was writing that book reading old medical journals, particularly journals published in the 19th century. And what I found very quickly was that if I'd be reading some article about heart disease, every time I turn a page, there'd be a really fantastic story about somebody who'd swallowed knives, or an elderly woman in Italy who'd burst into flames spontaneously, or a man in Chicago who taught his baby to swim underwater. And I realized that these old medical journals are stuffed full of these incredible stories which aren't really very well known. And so I started to collect them. And that's how it all got going, really. I mean, I've collected about 400 of them now, and this book contains about 60 or so of my favorites.
I love your disclaimer at the end of the introduction in this book, Thomas, if I may quote it here. I am not a doctor, and nothing within these pages should be construed as medical advice. Readers who choose to treat their ailments by administering port wine enemas, ingesting snake excrement, or smoking cigarettes steeped in mercury, do so at their own risk. My disclaimer at the beginning of our hour with you is, would you agree this book is probably not for everyone, especially the squeamish? Some of the cases we'll talk about may be a little disturbing to listeners, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, when I was I could easily have filled a whole book with stories that were just kind of disgusting or unpleasant. But actually, when I was putting the stories together, I was being quite careful to include some that were quite mild by the standards of 18th and 19th century medicine. But yes, there are certainly a few cases, particularly anything involving surgery, which could be maybe require a strong, a strong stomach, let's put it like that.
You have it broken up into sections, the sections being unfortunate predicaments, mysterious illnesses, dubious remedies, horrifying operations, remarkable recoveries, tall tales, and hidden dangers. You mentioned swallowing knives. Would you tell us about that case, which is in the, I guess, unfortunate predicaments section?
Yes, this is the case of a 19th century American sailor. In fact, it was reported in 1823, and his career as a knife swallower, if we can call it that, began in 1799. And the story is, his name was John Cummings, and he was serving on a ship which had docked in France, and he and some of his comrades went ashore for a night out, and they found themselves in a tent watching a stage show. It was like, I suppose it was, you know, like going to see Penn and Teller on stage in Vegas today. And there was a stage magician who had a trick which involved swallowing a knife, or pretending to swallow a knife. And John Cummings thought this was a great trick. And when they got back to the ship that evening after a lot of drink, he said he could do it as well as any Frenchman. And egged on by his friends, he swallowed his own clasp knife. And when he was asked if he thought he could do it again, he said, "All the knives aboard the ship." And that was the beginning of a slightly regrettable career of swallowing knives for a bet, basically. Mm-hmm. And some years later, he was actually admitted to hospital with terrible abdominal pain, as you'd probably imagine from having swallowed a lot of knives. And the doctors didn't believe him when he told them that he'd swallowed these knives. And it was actually only after he died and they examined the body, there was a post-mortem, that they found he really had been telling the truth. And they found 39 knives and fragments of knives everywhere between his stomach and the bottom of his intestines.
And as you note in the book, the knives were at various, well, depending on what the handles were made of, they were digested or not digested, right?
Yes, and in fact, it seems that the first few knives he swallowed just would pass straight through his gut without any difficulty at all. But at some stage, a bit later on, I think probably what happened is one of them got trapped somewhere in the small intestine. And then, yes, the knives that they found in his body after death, some of them had obviously been there for years. Because they were so badly corroded, and the material of the handle had gone completely, and others were obviously more recent. But yes, some of those knives have been in his stomach for a very long time.
Thomas Morris is my guest, writer and medical historian. His new book, The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine, 300 years of really bizarre tales, as Thomas just said. He has several hundred. These are his favorite tales. I wanted to play an excerpt, Thomas, if it's all right with you, from the audiobook version of this, in which you narrate it, but also have a gentleman named Rupert Farley join you, because you use this, you have a lot of journals from hundreds of years ago, right? And Rupert Farley is the voice you'll be hearing voicing the journals, and you are the narrator. I've picked a section, a case called the Tobacco Smoke Enema. So, Thomas, if that's all right with you, let's have a listen.
Sure.
Samuel Auguste André David Tissot was an eminent Swiss physician of the 18th century, the author of one of the first scholarly studies of migraine, and also remembered for his much-cited work on the evils of masturbation, l'onanisme. In 1761, he published Avis au peuple sur sa santé, a little book aimed at the general public and translated into English 6 years later. One of the early readers of this work was John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, who was fascinated by medicine and even had a small practice as an amateur physician, giving free care to those who could not afford a proper doctor. In 1769, he published his own version of Tissot's work, under the title Advices with Respect to Health. Although much of its guidance remains valid today, other sections are, well, a little outdated. Take, for instance, Tissot's advice on first aid in the event of near drownings, which begins sensibly enough.
Directions with respect to drowned persons. Whenever a person who has been drowned has remained a quarter of an hour underwater, there can be no considerable hopes of his recovery. The space of 2 or 3 minutes in such a situation being often sufficient to kill a man. Nevertheless, as several circumstances may happen to have continued life beyond the ordinary term, we should not give them up too soon, since it has often been known that after the expiration of 2 and sometimes even 3 hours, such bodies have recovered.
This sounds extremely unlikely. 7 minutes underwater is usually enough to cause fatal brain damage, and after half an hour, the chances of survival are virtually nil. Extremely cold water can increase this theoretical maximum, since hypothermia reduces the body's oxygen requirements and also triggers physiological mechanisms which effectively slow the metabolism. Even so, there are only a handful of cases in which people are known to have survived as long as an hour underwater, let alone 2 or 3. Tissot lists several measures that could be taken in order to improve the chances of recovery.
Immediately strip the sufferer. Rub him strongly with dry, coarse linen. Put him, as soon as possible, into a well-heated bed, and continue to rub him a considerable time together.
Before the advent of CPR, rubbing the body was thought to be the best way of restoring the circulation, even if the heart had stopped. Artificial respiration, on the other hand, was already known in the 18th century.
A strong and healthy person should force his own warm breath into the patient's lungs and the smoke of tobacco, if some was at hand, by means of a pipe introduced into the mouth.
Imagine a paramedic giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation while smoking a fag, and you'll get the general idea. Tissot, like many 18th century doctors, believed that the primary cause of drowning was not necessarily inhaled water, but the froth it created with gas inside the lungs. The theory behind this intervention was that tobacco smoke would dissolve the froth, causing the air to recover its spring, or pressure, a technical term borrowed from the experimental writings of Robert Boyle. Bleeding was, naturally, another vital component of emergency treatment.
If a surgeon is at hand, he must open the jugular vein and let out 10 or 12 ounces of blood. Such a bleeding renews the circulation and removes the obstruction of the head and lungs.
And why stop at blowing tobacco smoke into the patient's lungs? 2 orifices are better than 1.
The fumes of tobacco should be thrown up as speedily and plentifully as possible into the intestines by the fundament. 2 pipes may be well lighted and applied. The extremity of 1 is to be introduced into the fundament, and the other may be blown through into the lungs.
Tissot even recommends using a pipe attached to a bladder for this purpose, much like the bag mask ventilators used today by paramedics. Blowing tobacco smoke up into the rectum was not some eccentric idea of his own. As we've already seen, the technique was employed in the failed attempt to revive the unfortunate Earl of Kent and was widely used in 18th century Europe. It was known as Dutch fumigation, but the practice is believed to have been the invention of Native American tribes centuries earlier. Tissot's book was published just before the emergence of the Humane Societies, organisations dedicated to the study and practice of resuscitation. The first of these, the Society for the Recovery of Drowned Persons, was founded in Amsterdam in 1767. Others soon followed in Germany, Italy, Austria, France, and London. Dutch fumigation was believed to be so valuable a technique that tubes and bellows for blowing tobacco smoke into the fundament were installed in public places such as coffee shops and barber shops, just as defibrillators are today. But it was not just smoke that might be used.
Any other vapour may also be conveyed up by introducing a cannula, or any other pipe, with a bladder firmly fixed to it. This bladder is fastened at its other end to a large tin funnel, under which tobacco is to be lighted. This contrivance has succeeded with me upon other occasions, in which necessity compelled me to apply it. The strongest volatiles should be applied to the patient's nostrils. The powder of some strong dry herb should be blown up his nose, such as marjoram or very well dried tobacco.
It's a wonder the patient had any space left in his airways for oxygen, with all these substances being inserted into them.
As long as the patient shows no signs of life, he will be unable to swallow. But as soon as he discovers any motion, he should take within 1 hour a strong infusion of Cardus benedictus, of chamomile flowers sweetened with honey, and, supposing nothing else to be had, some warm water, with the addition of a little salt.
Cardus benedictus, also known as holy thistle, was believed to be a panacea by early modern medics. In Much Ado About Nothing, Margaret says to Beatrice, "Get you some of this distilled Cardus benedictus and lay it to your heart. It is the only thing for a qualm."
Notwithstanding the sick discover tokens of life, we should not cease to continue our assistance, since they sometimes expire after these first appearances of recovering. Lastly, though they should be manifestly reanimated, there sometimes remains an oppression, a coughing and feverishness, and then it becomes necessary sometimes to bleed them in the arms and to give them barley water plentifully.
The barley water doesn't sound too bad an idea, at least. Some of his suggestions are fairly dreadful, but Tissot concludes by condemning certain other treatments which are even worse.
"These unhappy people are sometimes wrapped up in a sheep's or calf's or a dog's skin, immediately flayed from the animal. But their operations are more slow and less efficacious than the heat of a well-warmed bed."
Yuck. This was, in fact, a measure often resorted to, though more usually on the battlefield, where warm blankets were sometimes hard to come by.
"The method of rolling them in an empty hog's head is dangerous and misspends a deal of important time. That also of hanging them up by the feet ought to be wholly discontinued."
Probably for the best. In fact, these were venerable and widespread practices. The hogshead method entailed securing the patient on top of, or within, a barrel placed on its side, which was then rolled back and forth. This gentle oscillation was supposed to evacuate water from the lungs, as was the cruder expedient of suspending the patient upside down. But these techniques were already beginning to go out of fashion. 15 years later, the influential Edinburgh physician William Cullen denounced them, asserting that they were extremely dangerous and often destroy the small remains of life. Tissot concludes with another helpful tip.
"The heat of a dung heap may also be beneficial, and I've been informed by a sensible spectator of it that it effectually contributed to restore life to a man who had remained 6 hours underwater."
I humbly submit that the sensible spectator was talking through his fundament.
Thomas Morris, what a wonderful section there. Advice on near drownings. Interesting that it was known also as Dutch fumigation. And is this really true that tubes and bellows were installed in public places to do this, much like defibrillators today?
Yes, I believe so. There was a lot of work done on this subject in the late 18th century, particularly anywhere like Amsterdam or London that had a lot of waterways, rivers, and, well, in the case of Amsterdam, you have all the canals there as well. And in an age when very few people knew how to swim, there were a lot of accidental drownings. And so this is the age of what became known as the Humane Societies, which were basically clubs for people who were trying to improve resuscitation techniques and teach them to other people. The techniques they used evolved over many years, but this tobacco smoke cure, which involved blowing tobacco smoke up the patient's bottom, was quite a significant technique for at least 30 years. So there was, you can still see some of these kits, actually. They're in medical museums in various parts of the world, and they contain everything you need to do, everything you need to blow tobacco smoke up a drowning person's bottom.
All right. Okay, also still with unfortunate predicaments, around the holidays, I guess we like to eat geese. This is an unfortunate predicament involving, I guess, eating geese from when? Honking like a goose, right? That is the title of this section.
Yes, this is a fantastic story, partly because some of these stories, when you read them, you think this can't really be true, and others are so strange, you think it's not possible to make it up. And this is the case of, in fact, it was a German, I think it was a peasant boy, who he and his friends, when their parents would kill a goose for the table, you'd cut the neck off, and they discovered that if you kind of blow through the neck of this dead goose, you can make it honk like a live goose because the larynx is still there, so you can simulate it. It's as if the goose is still alive. And this boy was a bit careless in blowing through the goose's neck, and he managed to inhale it. So when the doctor was summoned to see this unfortunate child, he found that when the child tried to speak, he honked like a goose. So it's a very strange predicament to be in. And the doctor didn't have too much difficulty in extracting this goose larynx from the poor child's throat. But it's a tale so strange it couldn't have been made up.
We have to take a break in a couple minutes, but mysterious illnesses. Tell us about this section.
One of my favorite sections, actually, because these are cases that some of them would have perplexed House MD, and I think others of them he definitely would have solved himself. One of the things that is quite interesting about this is that there's a publication that that was first published about 100 years ago by the World Health Organization, and it's basically a listing of every disease that exists. And the first edition contained about 110 different diseases. And we're now up to about 30,000 in the latest edition of this document. So there are lots of rare diseases which we have only identified in the last 30 years. So if you imagine you go back to the early 19th century, doctors are coming across diseases that maybe nobody else would see for another 50 years. And a lot of the illnesses in this chapter are the first reported incidents of a particular rare illness. But some of them are actually probably fictional diseases. They never really existed. To give an example, there's a story called The Dreadful Mortification, which comes from rural England in the 18th century. And it's a story of an entire family who fell ill. And the parents and the children were all affected by this illness, which made their limbs fall off, the extremities of their feet and hands. And the doctors who examined them had never seen anything like it. Now, we now know it was a phenomenon called ergotism, which comes from tainted grain. And they had made their bread from wheat which had been lying around and had got damp and had become infected by a fungus. And this fungus is unaffected by heat, so if you make bread from it, it's killed by the heat of the oven, but the toxins remain. And this was the first time this illness had ever been identified in the United Kingdom. But because it was so rare, nobody who saw it knew what it was.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Morris.
I always find those stories quite interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Fascinating. Thomas Morris, we have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. The mystery of the exploding teeth and other curiosities from the history of medicine. Thomas Morris, the author with us from London. He's a medical historian, also a writer of other medical books, a former BBC radio producer. We'll be back and talk more about, I think, mysterious illnesses, the human pincushion, the man who fought a duel in his sleep, the case of luminous patients. There's a favorite of mine. We'll find out if that can possibly be true. Bioluminescence that some animals on the earth have. Can people have it as well? We'll find out in just a minute. Thomas Morris, The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thomas Morris, my guest, joining us by phone from London. He's a medical historian. A new book out, The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine. These are some of medical history's weirdest, wildest medical cases. Thomas picked out a span of over 300 years to draw these from, the early 17th century to the turn of the 20th century. And these are genuine medical reports, mysterious illnesses, dubious remedies, operations that would horrify you. When we stopped, we were talking about mysterious illnesses. Tell us about the case you describe here of luminous patients. We know some animals have a bioluminescent quality, fireflies, what we call fireflies here in the U.S., for instance.
Yes, and it's not something you would associate with humans. You don't think of humans glowing in the dark. You know, sometimes if you go down to the beach on a summer's night, you might see the slight scintillation coming from the waves as they break against the sand. And this is a series of cases that were spotted and first noticed in the 1820s. And these were typically, the first cases mentioned, people on their deathbed. There's a very evocative description of a young woman who was dying probably from a cancer, and her family started to notice that even when there was no lamp on in her room, they noticed a slight sort of halo of light playing around her face, a slightly sort of unworldly phenomenon. And there were actually several other cases, most of which involved open wounds, patients who had some sort of wound on their body. And I think the likely explanation is that it was actually bioluminescence that you get from the creatures you mentioned, like glowworms and so on. There are various sorts of luminous bacteria which live in the sea. And butchers and people who handle raw meat are quite often aware of this, because if you have fish and meat in close contact, sometimes the meat will get infected with some of these luminous bacteria from the sea. So butchers are particularly in the age before, you know, food hygiene was quite as good as it is now. You could go into a meat safe and you would see the joints hanging off from the hooks, and they'd be kind of speckled with little spots like seeing stars in the night sky. And so it is quite plausible that some of these patients had been infected by these bacteria, which are commonly found in some foods, particularly raw meat. And it is a ghostly thing. You can imagine how, in an early generation, they might think it was something supernatural. But in all probability, it probably was just these bacteria, which are quite common.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the man. This is the title of this story, the man who fought a duel in his sleep. Somnambulism, a case of that. From when?
This case is from the 18th century. This is one of my favorites, actually, because it's there's nothing particularly medically remarkable about it, but it's just a lovely story. It was a student who went to stay with a priest and his family in Holland, and he warned them when he arrived that he was known to sleepwalk, and they weren't to be worried if he did sleepwalk. They didn't need to wake him up, just sort of gently lead him home, back to his bedroom. And it soon transpired that he actually did quite complicated things while fast asleep. So there's one case where he suddenly appeared in the main sort of living room of this house, and he played the harpsichord and pointed at pieces in the book of music that he wanted the young woman who lived there to play for him. And on another occasion, he was found in the dark arranging his books in alphabetical order. And on another occasion, he wrote and practiced a speech in Latin that he was going to be giving at his university the following day. But most spectacularly, he thought he had fought a duel he thought that he was fighting a duel in the house, and he believed he'd been shot, and he told his host that they had to go and get a surgeon to treat him. And the surgeon went through this sort of mime, pretending to treat him and take the musket ball out of his flesh. But the whole thing was a dream. He'd imagined the whole thing.
But the people, there were people who were awake, according to this account, who said, and so they just played along, and then once the musket ball was out of his gut, he was happy to, what, go back to sleep? I don't know if that's the right term.
Exactly right. Yes, he was the only person in the room who wasn't wide awake. Yes, the surgeon sort of said, no, I'm going to operate now, and here is the ball. He pulls it out, or pretends to pull it out, and from that point on, the young man who's been fast asleep this whole time realizes that he's all right.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Morris, my guest, a medical historian, The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine, his book. Let's talk about real operations. You have a whole section called Horrifying Operations, early medical literature containing numerous examples of, as you say, where surgeons attempting procedures going far beyond the boundaries of what was considered orthodox or even possible at that time. And it's interesting here that you learn a lot about medical history in this book of bizarre tales, that anesthesia was discovered in the mid-1800s. And you describe incredibly how there were operations, even amputations, performed before anesthesia, right?
Yes. I mean, there were a lot of surgery happened before anesthesia came along in the 1840s. But for the most part, the operations were limited to some quite straightforward, quick procedures. Surgery had to be very quick. So amputations, and surgeons took pride in being as quick as they could. They could take a leg off in under 4 minutes, or sometimes there would be procedures to remove cataracts from the eyes, which is not, it's not a terribly painful procedure compared to some others, and they could also remove bladder stones, which was notoriously painful. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until anesthesia came along that they started attacking more serious problems in the abdomen and the thorax. Mm-hmm. But that said, there was a lot of surgery going on, and it was, generally speaking, pretty horrifyingly painful for the poor patient.
Mm-hmm. And describe, I think it was a case of amputation where the man didn't exhibit the amount of sort of pain that one would expect from having an amputation, right?
Yes, there's this great story of a... in fact, it was written by a surgeon who lived through both eras. So he trained in the era before anesthesia, and then for the last 20 years of his career, he was able to use chloroform and ether. And much later in life, when he was long retired, he wrote these reminiscences of what it was like operating often in very small village communities in the Midlands in England in the 1820s. And he has this story of a time he had to amputate the arm of a man who'd he'd got his arm caught in a threshing machine. And it was very dark, the cottage room he was trying to operate in, and he couldn't see very well. And so this unfortunate patient offers to hold the candle for him. So he's holding the candle with his right arm, with his right hand, while the surgeon cuts off his left arm with on the other side of his body.
Ghastly. You bring us, this must be one of the most recent cases here when we're talking about operations, about surgery. You describe how a Russian scientist in Antarctica in 1961 is the best known case of self-surgery.
Yes, there aren't very many cases of this on record, but his case is really incredible. He was serving on this base, and in the middle of nowhere, he was probably 1,000 miles away from the nearest medical facilities. As it happens, he was the medical officer on the Antarctic base, and he was unlucky enough to develop appendicitis. And he realized that the only way of treating this was to have his appendix taken out. He wasn't a surgeon himself, but he also realized that there was nobody within 1,000 miles who could do the job for him. So after a day of phone calls with experts in Moscow, he decided to do it himself. And in fact, he started off conducting this operation. He rigged up a mirror so that he could see what was going on. But eventually he found it off-putting that everything was back to front in the mirror. So he performed the surgery himself by kind of craning his neck forward and looking inside his own abdomen to make sure he was grabbing the right bit. And he succeeded in removing his own appendix using only a sort of local anesthetic and with a couple of people there to hand him instruments and so on.
Mm. Let's talk about a couple of the cases you have, Thomas Morris, in the section called Tall Tales. I mentioned at the outset that you had spontaneous combustion, cases of that that you dealt with. Tell us about what you call the combustible countess from the 19th century, I guess.
It's much earlier than that, actually. It was an early 18th century case. It was quite a famous story at the time. It's not nearly so well known now. It was reported in the Journal of the Royal Society, which was the first scientific society here in the UK and one of the first in Europe. And her name was Cornelia Bandi. She was an Italian countess, and her death was mysterious. Her servant went to get her up one morning, and she wasn't answering the knocks on the door. So the servant went out to the front of the house and knocked on the window instead, and found there was something very strange going on inside. So she went back in and sort of opened the door. And this poor woman had somehow burnt to death, but not all of her body was affected. So this was a pattern that was became quite well known elsewhere. The body was quite badly burnt, but her legs were sort of separate and appeared untouched by the flames. And the assumption was several scientists, natural philosophers, went to investigate this, and they concluded that she had just caught fire spontaneously. Now, a more likely explanation, it turns out that she was in the habit of bathing in camphorated spirits, which is basically sort of an alcohol, and she lived in an apartment that was lit by candles mainly. So if you consider, she was basically bathing in flammable liquids and then walking through a space that was lit with naked flames. It doesn't take very much imagination to work out what had probably happened there.
Mm. We do know, I mean, objects, oily rags can spontaneously combust, but do we know of any cases where humans otherwise do? I mean, for supernatural reasons, I guess we're dealing with science here, so I guess we can't cast it off to supernatural reasons.
Well, most scientific experts now believe that there were hundreds of these cases between the 18th century and the mid 19th century. There were hundreds of reported cases of spontaneous human combustion, and in fact, Charles Dickens, in one of his novels, I think it's Bleak House, he bases the death of one of his characters, who supposedly dies from spontaneous human combustion, and he based it very closely on this account we just mentioned of the countess in Italy. But what the scientists think probably happened was that a lot of these people, of course, this is an era when candle flames and oil flames and gas flames were everywhere in the house, and clothing was often very flammable as well. And the clothing often seems to have acted as a sort of wick. So the body fat was burning, and it was being wicked off by the clothes, and that's how it burnt. And it's a kind of it's an unpleasant fact, but that's what seems to have been going on here.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Morris is my guest, if you've just joined us. The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine, a new book out. As you mentioned at the outset, you've collected hundreds of cases. What did you say? Up to 400 cases. This book contains some 70 of your favorite. As a medical historian, going back, you know, sometimes to the 17th century, how do you judge whether the veracity of a case, or some of them are just you come to a dead end and you say, I don't know what happened?
Exactly that. Yes. It is very difficult to judge sometimes because these days scientific journals tend to have quite a high bar you have to cross to get over, or in terms of proof. And scientists now don't take it on trust that something's true. They want the data to show that something's true. Now, in the 18th century and the 19th century, medical journals were taken much more on trust. A doctor would often write something and send it to a journal, even if they hadn't seen it themselves. If, say, a friend had told them, another doctor, and sometimes that a friend had told them and they got it from somebody in the village. So some of these stories you do have to take with a grain of salt, because it may be that just somebody in the village made up a story and then told the doctor, and the doctor believed them. And in fact, as you mentioned, the last chapter of this book is called Tall Tales, and it contains some stories which are just too implausible to be possible. There were a lot of cases in the 19th century where patients claimed that they'd had lizards or snakes or frogs or snails living inside their stomachs. Now, we know that that is impossible. There's no way that any of those creatures could live inside a human being for more than a few minutes. But they were reported regularly in the medical journals.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Thomas, when you wrote and conceived this book and wrote it, it's a very funny book, very funny writing here. I laughed out loud several times over the weekend reading it. I wonder if you had any misgivings or apprehensions or had to sort of be the self-editor about how to deal with, at times, very serious ailments, predicaments, injuries, even fatalities, at the same time you're writing a humorous book. That is a chore.
Yes, it is. And, I mean, I hope I haven't crossed the line into bad taste in any of these stories. There were stories which I've written about elsewhere, which I would definitely not include in a book like this, because they are just inherently serious and not very funny. And this is basically a light-hearted book. I didn't want to get into that sort of difficulty. You do have to remember and remind yourself sometimes that these were, apart from there are a few stories that I think are probably hoaxes, but there were real people here. These are real lives you're writing about. So I hope I've treated them with the sensitivity they deserve where that is the case.
In your final section, a hilarious part, why children should never wear hats. I have my book in front of me. I wonder if you have yours in front of you.
Yeah, yes, I do. Yes, yes.
I wonder if we could do a little bit of dialogue here. You have on page 302 the question and answer. We could play parts here, and you could set it up here, and we would discover why children should never wear hats.
Okay.
So set it up here. What is the source of this?
So this is a little book that was published for the first time in Germany in 1792 by a doctor called Bernhard Christoph Faust. And he was a personal physician to an aristocrat called Countess Juliane of Hesse-Philippsthal. And he wrote a book called Catechism of Health. And it was one of the first books, certainly the earliest one I'm aware of, that was aimed at children. It was about how you should stay healthy, how you should behave, and how to understand your own body. It was a great idea for a book, really. Just as a side note, I mean, he sent this book to America, hoping that the American educational system would be able to use it. And in fact, George Washington approved of it. And Benjamin Rush, one of the founding fathers, wrote an introduction for that first American edition. But it's quite an engaging little book, even if he does have a few strange ideas.
Okay, so the section we're going to read is a question and answer from what document here?
This is a chapter that's devoted to what clothes it's suitable for children to wear when they're in childhood, before they get to their teens.
Okay, so I'll do the questions, and you would please do the answers. Question: by what means does man preserve, particularly in his infancy, the genial warmth of his body?
By good, wholesome food and bodily exercise.
Is it necessary to keep children warm and protect them against the inclemency of the weather by many garments?
No.
Why so?
That the body may grow healthy and strong and be less liable to disease.
How ought the heads of children to be kept?
Clean and cool.
Is it good to cover children's heads with caps and hats to keep them warm?
No, it is very bad. The hair is a sufficient protection against cold.
Are those artificial coverings dangerous and hurtful?
Yes. Children are thereby rendered simple and stupid, breed vermin, become scurfy, full of humors, and troubled with aches in their heads, ears, and teeth.
Okay. A couple more questions here. What kind of caps are what kind of caps are therefore the most dangerous?
The woolen, cotton, and fur caps.
How, then, ought the heads of children to be kept?
Boys, as well as girls, ought to remain uncovered, winter or summer, by day and by night.
Okay. How did he arrive at these conclusions and this bit of advice for children?
It's very difficult to know, isn't it? He was very much in favor of smocks. He thought this is the only thing that children should wear, both boys and girls. But I should say also, he was quite enlightened in other ways. So he thought that corsets were really terrible for girls' health. And in fact, 100 years later, the Victorians worked out that that was true, that the whalebone corsets that were so tightly laced a lot of the time actually had a terrible effect on the skeletons and internal organs of particularly growing girls. And in some cases, they caused permanent and irreversible harm. So he wasn't wrong in everything, this guy.
Okay. Thomas Morris, it's been a delight to be with you this hour. The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth and Other Curiosities from the History of Medicine, a reading book, and an audio book out there on this. Thomas Morris, a former BBC radio producer. It's been a delight to be with you, Thomas Morris. I wonder, will there be a follow-up to this? Would you dare to come into more contemporary times? I have to believe there are so many cases in the 20th and 21st century.
Oh, yes, there are hundreds of these cases, and in fact, every so often I see one and think I'd better do a 20th century collection as well. So we'll see.
Okay, Thomas Morris, thank you so much for joining us from London.
Thanks, my pleasure.
And that does it for our program today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can find podcasts of all of our previous programs by going to iowapublicradio.org. Just do a pull-down menu to find River to River. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.